House Resources is what? Come to order, now in session, et cetera, et cetera. Bryce Edgman, Vic Coring, Paul Seaton, co-chair Craig Johnson, Representative Peggy Wilson, co-chair Carl Gatto, myself. We have before us a friend of mine for a large number of years, actually. Doug and I have met in Denver and other places. Doug Farquhar represents NCSL, and my big complaint to him all the time through NCSL has been agriculture and rural development, and I'm going to tell my statement over and over. I says, we have a lot of rural, we just don't have much development. And Doug has been the guy I've been working with. What can we do? What can we do for villages? And I said, Doug, ethanol is not going to do it. A lot of the villages and small communities in America are switching corn growing and making ethanol. We can't do that. So I asked Doug, could he come by and I'd give him the floor, or the ability at least to talk to us about it. And so, Doug, I'm going to need you, for the record, introduce yourself, spell your last name, because he's writing it down.
Okay.
and then tell us your affiliation, and then we'll shut the lights and we can proceed.
Well, thank you, Representative Gatto. I am Doug Farquhar, F-A-R-Q-U-H-A-R. I'm with the National Conference of State Legislatures, and I appreciate the time today speaking about this issue. And I'm going to give you a little bit of history about what I have been doing over the past many years. I've been with NCSL since 1991. And in about 1998 or 9, I started beginning to work with USDA and the Kellogg Foundation regarding issues on rural development. And at even though USDA has always had a rural development office, at that time the Kellogg Foundation moved forward and said, here's an issue we're not addressing, it's not being addressed very well. And when we started looking at it, and I started talking to state legislators about it, I was really quite surprised about the depth of the issue and how much of a gap it is. And it's very interesting in talking with state legislatures across the country, and of course, I deal with them all across the country, from Maine to California to Alaska to Florida. And we have a list of people from rural areas, and a lot of times to be a rural legislator you have to think that you're a rural legislator. You may or may not be. There's a good friend of mine, Mac Middleton from Maryland, and he is the king of the rural legislature, and by God, I think his district's about 10 miles wide, and that's extremely rural in Maryland versus out here. One of my great stories, I did an article for State Legislatures Magazine. I don't know if you recognize that magazine, but I know you all get it, on rural development at one time, and I did a list of just a sidebar on size of districts. And of course, we began back east with Maryland, and then I talked to Larry Mumper, and Larry is a good friend of ours, and he was complaining he has to put 40,000 miles on his car every year to get around northwestern Ohio. And then I went to talk to the Representative Gallegos along the Texas border there, and his goes all the way from Eagles Pass up to El Paso there, and I finally got to, it was Georgiana Lincoln's district, and of course, which, the size of Texas, and I asked her, well, how do you actually campaign in that district? She goes, well, I go to a lot of family reunions, and that's about, which I always thought was probably an interesting story, but we get, you do have a wide diversity in rural America. And I think one of the issues that I really want to highlight, and one of the things that Carl keeps on noting, is that what is rural to some parts of this country, what's going to be development to some parts of the country, isn't going to work everywhere. And when I work with USDA and the Kellogg Foundation and the Rural Policy Research Institute and the Center for Rural America and all these different think tanks that are out there to deal with rural America, they keep on getting back to, like Carl says, ethanol. It's corn. We got to figure out new ways to do something with sugar. They're not talking about, what about mining? What about do about oil and gas? What do we do about timber? What do we do about fisheries? And these are things that constantly, I think, are getting forgotten. So anyway, I want to kind of make up a couple points here, which this is just to lay it out for the from the national point perspective. And the reason I do this is to really kind of enlighten people in Congress and at USDA. Even though it's a quarter of the nation's population, we've got 83% of the land mass. But this is the big thing. Rural legislators are becoming rare. You're all...
Seconds. Representative Kawasaki has joined us, and I'm going to move my seat over.
Okay. And this is one of the things I think is going to be very relevant. The redistricting that is occurring right now, a couple of things I want to highlight. One of the redistricting maps that came out of Colorado was to put a spoke system right on the Capitol, and then they spoked it out from Denver. So basically, everybody could live in Denver and represent the entire part of the state. Well, the rural legislators did not like that, as obviously, even though economically it made sense, you know, convenience-wise, it made sense because you had a population base, but it really left out rural legislators. It made a lot of sense, though, which is what the scary part was. The Nebraska map has really gotten interesting because everyone considers Nebraska a rural legislature. Well, majority of the legislature is either from Omaha or Lincoln. Actually, we're down to about 40% is from rural areas. Texas is a very exact district. I talked to a guy who's just outside of Houston. He's always represented a rural district. He's very proud of his rural roots. And he said one of his ranches on the edge of the district sold out to a developer. He goes, I got 100,000 new people in my district. He goes, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And what happened was he lost his seat. That's what generally happens. Census data goes against rural legislators. And I'm sure you're probably going to see that here. But what a lot of states have done is created these rural caucuses. And that's what I wanted to somewhat bring up today. What these caucuses are trying to do is not so much advocate for rural issues as to make sure the rural issues do not get lost in the legislative process. To make sure that when you're going through talking about getting funding for education, allocating your Medicaid dollars, that the rural areas do get their fair share, that they are respected and they are heard from. The big issue that I keep on hearing from legislators is that rural issues get lost because we have too many urban legislators. How do we bring that issue forward? Well, they've created these caucuses, and essentially they're just trying to maintain maintain services and resources for the rural areas. Now, these are the things I kind of have come up with. And if you disagree with me, let's talk about it. But the federal farm bill, the federal farm policy, I have not seen supporting widespread rural economic development and rural economic growth. It is on the farm bill. The scary thing about that is, well, I think it's probably good for this state, but for many states, the farm bill is going to be dramatically different this year, I believe. And a lot of that has to do with the one thing is they don't have the budget they've had in the past. Number two, our trading partners are telling us that we cannot be given subsidies out. Number three, corn does not need subsidies at $5 a bushel now. Basically, the corn people are pulling out of the subsidy game, so why should they knock themselves out? But they got to make a decision by September 30th, because if they do not make a decision, they do not pass a farm bill, it reverts back to the 1948 farm bill, which really gums the entire system up. So something is going to get addressed there. But natural resources economy is not effectively addressed by the federal government. It generally seems to be locked up in the Department of Interior, BLM, Forest Service, trying to keep dealing with the economies that way. It's not something that is very well discussed among the states. I'm sure you're very frustrated with the federal government controlling most of the land in this state. That's a notorious issue of all Western legislators, and that's something I find is not very effectively addressed in the rural discussions. And that's something I'd like to work with you all about, is trying to figure out a way we can respond to that and help me out to talk when we go talk to USDA and when we talk to some of these policymakers and when we talk there's going to be a rural summit paid for by the Kellogg Foundation, and they're going to be sitting down with Congress and talking about rural issues. And I'm having trouble getting this on the agenda to say that you can't have a discussion on rural development without realizing that the federal government owns all this land and they really limit about what people can do. And that's something that you can't have rural development in a rural area if you have restrictions on developing your land and resources. That's something I think I would really like to start addressing. Globalization. There's no way we cannot integrate globalization into the rural economy. You can't simply say that it has no impact because it's having major impact. Our manufacturing base is going overseas. Things that never were an issue before, such as getting farmed raised salmon from Chile. Couldn't do that 10, 20 years ago. You can do it easily now. You don't have the barriers any longer. And the basic barriers that you used to be able to have out there where they just simply had a tariff, they simply had, all you had to do was have somebody at the port saying, we ain't going to take this, that was it. You can't do that anymore. And you got to bring it in, and if you bring it in, if you don't want to have it in here, you got to figure out an exact reason why you can't have it and make sure you have a big set of lawyers and a lot of economists to back you up to say, yes, this is something that's in violation of health and safety regulations and something we cannot have in this country. And if you ever really want to get me going, we'll get going on trade, because trade agreements and states are not in agreement with one another, and it's not been very good for states from a state policymaking point of view. If you're going to say that it's been good for the economy overall, probably. But when a state legislature passes a law and then it gets repealed or gets pulled back because of an international agreement with India or with the European Union or with Singapore, then you have some issues out there that we probably need to be able to address. And my final point was just framing principles for the new rural economy, trying to get points out there to figure out how do we address the issues that really affect people in this state. How do we really be able to say on the table when you go into Congress or when you go into USDA that, yes, you have all these rural corn farmers that have problems out here, but there are new issues over here. We got people in rural Alaska who cannot grow corn, and that is not going to be an option for them. We got to figure out a new way of saying, what is rural development? How can we build this up? We are not going to make a new Telluride in rural Alaska. We may, but that's not probably going to be the direction, and we're probably not going to have an ethanol plant. We probably will be able to do other things to build up the development and make sure that people have an economic base that they can work from. Again, this is just my comment on federal lands. Your map's much better than mine, but there was a great series of maps that came out from the University of Colorado, and what they did was they kind of went through each one of the states showing how much land is owned by the federal government. And you go east of the Mississippi River, and it's like negligible, hardly anything at all. You go west, now Texas, it's all owned by Texas. They made sure of that. The only thing that's federal there is basically military bases. But you get further and further west, half of California, 93% of Nevada. I think, what is Alaska? Is it like in the 99%? Ron? You know, it's just, so when you got that kind of lockup, it's very hard for you to come in and sit down and work with a group of congressmen who have nothing to relate to when they say, well, you need to develop, here's ways you can develop your economy, and you're like, well, yeah, we can't do that because we're totally being controlled by the Department of Interior. And that is just something I think we need to figure out a smart way to bring that issue forward to not only USDA and the federal government, but several of these foundations. Don't want to get into this too much, but this is just a list of the laws that apply. Each one of these limit what Alaska can do and limit what many Western states can do on federal lands. And it just it puts a barrier on all states trying to put something together. Rural economic development, I don't know if I really need to address this to this group, because I think you realize that the economy in rural area in rural America is not keeping up. In fact, it's lagging behind. The natural resource economy is extremely difficult one to maintain. I can speak from experience, because my grandfather was a miner in Cripple Creek and it didn't work. After a while, these things play out, and the federal government is not encouraging that any longer. The logging industry, the fishing industry, all these things are making things much more difficult for people in rural areas. Let's see if this is the this is the net out migration. Okay, this is where people are moving out of and where they're going to. And if you can see, look at that massive, it's all the rural areas. The only places that are growing in Alaska are around Anchorage. And I think you all know this for a fact, that this is where people are moving to. And you can see that across the country, too. People are leaving the rural areas, and they are moving to the more urban areas.
Doug, why doesn't Southeast prosper more than it does? Is it transportation, or?
You're talking about Southeast America or Southeast Alaska?
Southeast America is Florida.
I can tell you.
You know, and I, one of the, my point would be, and you guys probably have a better sense of this than I do, but it's the natural resource economy. One, all your land's locked up with the U.S. Forest Service. And there are bureaucrats back in D.C. that have a lot more authority than you guys do. And because they can tell what's going to happen to that land. I think there's very little private land available in Southeast.
Yeah, right.
And you have control over the private land, and the Forest Service has control over the public land. If you switch that around, you do see changes. I'm really coming from Colorado counties that where the federal government has allowed economic development to occur, you've really seen some expansion. And if you see in the north central part of the state there towards the west, we're seeing a boom going on there, and it's because natural gas, and that's because this administration has allowed natural gas development to occur there. And places like Rangeley and Rifle, which were down to about 600-700 people, have now about 6,000 or 7,000 going into that area, and it's because they're opening up natural gas, which means you got people developing it, you got the environmental people doing the EISs, you have truck drivers hauling stuff in and natural gas out, and you got the whole economy that occurred. But it was a decision by the Department of Interior to say we're going to open it up. You open up and allow economic development to occur, it does occur. And so that's my only spin. Unless anybody else has any other comments about southeastern Alaska.
Well, one other thing is that on all our resource-based things, such as timber and fishing, there have been market prices.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's driven, you know, more than the restriction on the stumpage has actually been lately is the market price. I mean, when you have trade agreements that import timber lower than we can produce it.
Right.
You know, you have a real problem when you have the fish price competition. You have a real problem keeping the those economies going. So I'm not disagreeing that federal government ownership, especially of those lands, is a real drag, but it hasn't been our only drag.
Yeah, and that's back to my point about globalization. You know, there are much cheaper areas to produce everything, timber, mining, etc. You know, it's just less on labor, less on the environmental costs. There's and when you deal with trade agreements and you look about the way they're written, you start going in and saying, well, wait a second, you're saying we got to do everything on an equal level, but we have these other costs which we have to pay for. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not an issue whether we can or can't. You have to pay for it. You have to pay for the environmental standards. You got to pay for the the studies. You got to pay for moving it out in an environmentally sensitive manner. You have to pay for people's health care a lot of times. You got to pay for employees. And do you have to do that in Chile? Well, maybe not. And do we have a free trade agreement with Chile? Yeah. And it's just it. And when you're a businessman sitting there in L.A. and you have to buy a certain product, do you go to Alaska or do you go to Chile? Well, might be more economical to go to Chile these days. And that's something that really hits the rural economies. And I don't have an easy answer. Everyone kind of looks and say, okay, what's the answer? There isn't one. There isn't one. All I do know is that states really often do not have people at the table when talking about these trade agreements. And each one of those commodities that we talk about, whether it be, you know, mineral, oil and gas, lumber, textiles, whatever the case may be, there is a person back in D.C. who spends hours trying to study this stuff and write this stuff and put it down to negotiate. And, you know, bless their heart, sometimes they win, sometimes they lose. But in the bottom run, you kind of see in which direction the world's going. And Alaska's going to get dragged into it along with the rest of rural America. Okay. Again, like I said, it's this is my big issue out there, right? One of those things that really bug me. The bottom line is, and if you talk to a U.S. trade representative, if you talk to the federal government, you talk to World Trade Organization, they simply say that states can't give a preference to the to local purchasers. You have to even it. If you're going to buy Alaska, you have to give them the same preferences as the person in China or the person in wherever. It's supposed to be equal across the board. But there's, you know, the world is so complicated. How do you make it equal across the board? And as we said, how do you say it's equal if you have to make it equal, but you have to pay for labor at this cost, or you have to pay for medical, or you have to pay for health and safety regulations? That's a cost that comes to you. That's something that third world people do not have to pay. FRTC versus NACIOS is the Burma case. And the reason I want to bring that case up, and I, you know, this is one for legal junkies, but Massachusetts passed a law like it did back in 1980 regarding South Africa, except for this one was against Burma. And it said, if you're going to do business with the country of Burma and you want to do business with the state of Massachusetts, we're going to assess a 10% penalty against you, a fee, and we're going to use that money to educate the people about the atrocities in Burma. That case went to the U.S. Supreme Court. What happened was originally Switzerland, of all countries, brought suit against the U.S. to overturn this law. And then there was a group called the Federal Relations Trade Council out of D.C. They took the case. They were able to bring it to the federal court. And in that instance, they were able to, and as a U.S. company or as a U.S. entity, they were able to use the federal court system. And the federal court and the Supreme Court said trade agreements are now federal foreign policy and states don't have a role. And so basically they repealed that law and they said, Massachusetts, you cannot have this law on the books. Now, that you know, made us all take a step back. And the reason from the legal standpoint we get excited about this is because most trade agreements does not give an individual the right to sue a state. It gives the individual company or the country itself can bring a suit against the entire U.S. So the question is, well, is that country going to bring a suit against the entire U.S.? This changed the whole dynamics where they said an individual company can bring suit against the state over a trade agreement that was negotiated by the federal government on an international basis. That changes the dynamic dramatically. Now, we've been working on checking out some issues out there, and one of them is local food preferences, buying food made in a local in that state. All of them are in violation of this trade agreement, but we have 20 states out there that have adopted laws on this. Okay, what's going to happen? I don't know. As long as people are happy, nothing's, you know, as long as we don't have a case or controversy, we're fine. But I'm still thinking about Canada with its lumber dispute, the softwood lumber dispute. I'm thinking about Canada with its salmon. Is that going to come back to haunt you? Yeah. And the question is, do you have somebody at the table? And probably, I'm assuming you probably don't. And I'll get into Canada in a minute here. Exports, imports, I don't want to really knock this thing out too much outside the fact that 20% of all imports are coming into this country. Walmart just, I know Representative Gatto loves Walmart, and they're a great company. He says they brought duct tape at a reasonable price to Alaska, which is, but they do, they're the number one purchaser of product from China. And they are doing great things for the Chinese economy. It's really, they have really, probably if there's been one single company in the world that has turned the Chinese economy around, it's been Walmart. Because they have opened up those doors, and that's where the product's coming in from. U.S., on the other hand, we have about 12% of the world exports. And as you probably can imagine, that's coming from agriculture and Boeing. That's our two big things. If Boeing goes away, that thing drops dramatically. But the bottom line is that raw material and feedstocks, the natural resource economy, which you guys have been based on, is coming in from different countries. And it's not coming in from the U.S. any longer. This is how many states have decided to respond to it. Not only come up with rural caucuses, they've created rural agencies. The couple I want to highlight here, the first one is North Carolina. The governor, back in the late 80s, realized that half the state, this was during the time of a discussion about welfare reform, and he discovered that half the state, the poor, is in rural areas. Yes, we have no resources for it. All the resources are designed to go to urban areas. So he created this Rural Economic Development Center basically to identify the problems in rural areas, bring those issues to head, and try to get more federal resources coming into rural North Carolina. The Center for Rural Pennsylvania, again, that was along the same lines. Rural areas are inherently not as well represented in Congress, and they don't have as much attention among the federal agencies. So you need to figure out a way to bring that data forward, which is very easily accessible in urban areas, into a rural context, so you can have a capability of talking about this. And these are just several bills that have come forth, and I don't really want to belabor this too much, but the point being is that state legislatures are starting to take a role in rural economic development, and that they're offering tax incentives, they're offering enterprise zones, they are coming up with loans. North Dakota this year is going to provide $500,000 to fund farmers markets, which I know may not be a big issue there here, but there's only 500,000 people in the state. So basically everybody in the state is going to pay a buck for farmers markets, which I thought was a heck of a commitment to get through. Just in closing, I just want to kind of bring up a couple points. Back to Canada, back to Idaho. Both places have taken a real aggressive approach in trying to address their rural constituencies, and both trying to make sure that they are very active on the market. The Idaho put together this document talking about the profile of rural Idaho, and what they are trying to do with this document is give the data that is necessary for rural areas to be able to apply for federal grants and be able to get loans and get product from the federal government, but they needed it to be couched in a certain way that rural areas don't really have the staff to do. This is what this effort is trying to do, and what they're also trying to do, and many states are trying to put together or are putting together, is identifying a single state employee who's dedicated to getting federal money to rural areas. And they are trying, and what their job is basically to get the data designed in a way that is going to make it attractive to gain the rural dollars. Canada, whenever I deal with globalization, there's always a Canadian there. They are everywhere. I go down to Mexico to talk about environmental issues. There are Canadians there. I go, we go back to D.C. to talk about trade issues. There are Canadians there. They're a very aggressive country because, as they said, their economy is based on trade, and they're very much at the table. That's very good for Canada. It's going to be a negative for many of the states that have the same economic base as Canada. That's something that you may want to take thought about because I don't know if Alaska really considers Iowa and Illinois their economic challenges more than British Columbia. But they are definitely there at the table. So with that, I'd like to put the question out to you all. What kind of topics and what kind of comments do we need to get back to USDA and Kellogg Foundation to say we need to meet the needs of rural Alaska?
Convert this to informal, and I'll just let you be the chair. I think Bryce had a question first, and then Peggy Wilson had a second.
Yes, thank you, first off, for coming all the way up to Alaska.
Oh, my pleasure.
We do have a lot of rural legislators sitting around the table here. I would respectfully add that I guess one key point to your presentation I didn't see, and that's the cost of energy.
Yeah.
If you talk about not just the household economy and the the largest single deterrent for living up bush Alaska these days, it's because the cost of energy is just killing people out there. And if you expand that into economic development of any scale, well, the cost of energy can make or break the company's decision to go out to bush Alaska because it's just prohibitively expensive. And it seems to me that Bush Alaska, a good part of Bush Alaska, is not connected via the road system, and therefore the economy is of scale, and every component of the cost factor for living out there is so different than it would be for a rural area in Georgia or North Dakota or almost anywhere lower 48. So to me, that's a key component that at least to the Alaskan audience to keep in mind.
Yeah, the price of oil has an enormous impact on every rural, it has an impact on everyone, but I think it gets accelerated because you need it just to get around. And it just amplifies everything. And I do know of businesses, small businesses, that have had to relocate to cities just simply because they have transportation issues. And even though they would like to stay in their rural areas, they can't. So I don't have an easy answer to that. Obviously, high oil prices has been both a blessing and a curse for the state, but it's something that has to be recognized.
I'm going to tag on to that. General aviation in this state, general aviation is essential in the bush, and the feds just tacked 50 cents a gallon on the general aviation fuel. And for people in the bush, another 50 cents a gallon, where you don't have a road or a railroad or a boat or anything, is devastating. And we're kind of trying to get that overturned, but we're Alaska. We don't have terrific sway. But similarly, the cost of energy and the feds just made it even harder.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Wilson from Southeast.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment because my husband lives in Bryce's area and in his district. And anything that weighs anything, everything has to be flown in. And
right. Anything
that weighs anything, and when he first got there, which was in July, head of cabbage, he bought, he didn't really pay too much attention to what it was going to cost. And when he got up the cash register, $9 for a head of cabbage.
Are you kidding?
No. And
I'm sorry, where are
that's in Bristol Bay.
Southwest Alaska.
Yeah.
Okay, that's Southwest.
Yeah.
And you're in Southeast Alaska?
Yes. And what I'm saying is that's not even in one of the villages.
Yeah.
That was in one of the areas where it's not considered a village.
Right.
But it's much worse the further you go out because it's another plane trip or further on a barge to get something, and it costs by weight. And gasoline in some of these areas are $5 and $6 a gallon. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like it's, oh my goodness, it's high, it's $3 a gallon.
It's 5 or 6.
It just, the further you go, and in Alaska,
it just multiplies.
Yes. And it's very difficult, especially in those rural areas or in what I call villages are worse because most of them don't even have roads or anything like that. In southeast Alaska, it's not too difficult. We can get by boat, but our transportation system is absolutely, totally undependable. So even though
I flew up here yesterday, I know that.
Well, I'm talking about like the ferry system.
Sure.
They change it so much that people can't depend on it, you know, because they know next week it might not be what it is this week. Mm-hmm. And so the ferry system is undependable. And because of weather, depending on what time of the year it is, usually it's in the wintertime, in the summertime, I got on Alaska Airlines plane 71 times last year, and only twice was there a problem with getting where I wanted to go. Mm. So as far as, you know, but most of that was just within my district, you know, because each town is on a different island.
Sure.
And so it's very difficult to...
Are you in Ketchikan?
No, but I'm between Ketchikan and Juneau.
Wrangell,
okay. Petersburg, Sitka, Pelican, Elfin Cove, Port Alexander, you know, lots of little different places.
Sure.
But they're... To get to, you know, you have to either spend a lot of money in charter or try to, and what you end up having to do is taking a ferry one way and then chartering to get back out,
right,
or some version thereof. But the majority of the land in southeast is the Tongass National Forest. Right. And there is plenty of forest that they could cut and never stop and still be able to renew itself.
Yeah,
I mean, that can be renewable energy. But the federal government has just got us. You know, we used to have lots of logging and lots of sawmills. And now the little bit that they give us is so small, and the parcels that they give us, and they won't let us put any roads in, so we have to do it with a helicopter. So if you can imagine going in, lifting up one or two logs and the cost of that. So anyway, we really need some relief on economic development, and it's on federal land.
Well, you know, and we were chatting earlier, and of course everyone's thrilled with ethanol right now, and price of corn's going up. But it's the only reason we can make ethanol out of corn in this country right now is well, we get a 50-cent a gallon subsidy, but two, we got a quote, we got a certain amount that only can come in from Brazil. Brazil makes their ethanol at $1 a gallon. I mean, it's dirt cheap. And the U.S. has a barrier on how much you can bring in. So you start talking about the technologies, what you can do in the future. And I got friends over at the National Renewable Energy Labs, and they said, you know, corn, you know, using the stalks, using all the who cares? It's not that good. He goes, what's good is wood. That's what they really need. And they don't need the big, wonderful, expensive cheese. They need that trash, you know, the stuff that just kind of grows up. And they said, even after a forest fire goes through, we can take that wood and use it. And we munch it up, and we can make it, turn it into a fuel. And now they don't have the subsidies yet. They don't have the economic. I mean, it takes a while to get these technologies going. But Wall Street is real excited about this. And if you can actually, you know, want to talk about a perfect area to do it, you got plenty of wood if you can get the federal government to let you use it. In some places, like, you know, Montana, let's be honest, it takes almost 100 years to grow a decent tree. That's the reason that you talk about Louisiana Pacific. It's in the southeast, which can grow a tree in 20 years, and the northwest, which can grow a tree in about 20, you have the economic conditions, the natural conditions to do that. There are some real exciting things that can be done, but the problem is, again, you have to represent people in southeast Alaska for decisions that are being made in Washington, D.C. And you know, I've actually met people in Washington, D.C., and they have these beautiful pictures of some state in the West, and they said, yeah, you know, I keep that up there because I'm doing all these regulations and I've got all this stuff. And I said, have you ever been there? No. You know, they just, it's, just kind of the weird way this country operates. And for me, you know, not that I'm a, you know, I'm nothing. I'm just, you know, but I am asked to speak a lot of times on what do state legislatures think about issues such as rural development. And these are the issues I often try to bring up, saying they need to be able to make the decisions because they're getting blamed for this stuff. And it's, you know, probably not fair. I'm sure you've been accused of things that you had no nothing oversight on. But that's just part of the reality. And I do believe that, you know, technology has some great opportunities out there, but it's we got a changing economy that we have to really expect to resonate with.
I talked to Doug about some possibilities in rural areas, and that is because energy is so high, the presence of a windmill could be enormously beneficial. And I told him about Galena, where they're using nuclear down deep, 300 or 350 feet, to make 700-degree steam to run a turbine. Wood chips.
Yeah.
And squeezing oil out of fish for making biodiesel as an aid. Things along those lines.
And another thing we didn't talk about, which is healthcare and education via the internet. And now we're getting less and less in need of having these cables provide everything, one, and two, we're actually getting those that service out to places. You know, I think the biggest thing for economic development has been cell phones and the internet. And there's actually school districts, rural school districts that have closed all their buildings. They're doing all of it via the internet.
In their homes?
Yeah, in the homes. Just because they say they can't afford to have they had to make a decision. Do we want to have a building? Do we want to have teachers? Let's have teachers. Put them here, and you teach everybody online. I teach online courses for the University of Denver. It works. I have a student in McMurdo Station, Antarctica. They have nothing better to do during the winter, so.
They say the same thing about us.
I can see through university and things like that, but you're talking at a grade
public school.
What state's doing that?
Colorado. Colorado's doing it in the Branson School District, which is down along the New Mexico-Colorado border, kind of towards the eastern part of the state. And they were the first to do it. And healthcare is doing the same thing because you can't get doctors to live and respond to something, but can you get a public health nurse? Well, probably. Well, how do we handle this? Well, let's tap into cdc.gov and see how we handle it. Now, are they going to be able to do heart surgery? Probably not. I don't think you want them to. But will you be able to handle a heck of a lot more cases than otherwise? Yeah. And those are the parts of rural development. I mean, too often I think we get caught up in saying, we need to bring this business here. We need to figure out some way to make marketable things. More so, maybe that you have the transportation corridors, that you have the educational opportunities, that you have the services that allow you to have people come in and come up with an industry and an entrepreneurship. And that's and of course, that's not something that's straightforward or easy, but that's something that I think when you talk about rural economic development, you know, the cell phone and the internet have really allowed for a lot of things to happen.
I'll bring up another one, but first I want to mention that Representative Guttenberg joined us somewhere around a half hour ago, and I didn't get a chance to say it, but I want to talk about farming, spelling farming with a PH.
Oh, because, farm, yeah.
Because pharmaceuticals, my understanding, and I know I'm right, is that there was a French company that contracted with an American farmers to grow this genetically modified corn, which, because it was modified, produced the drug to treat cystic fibrosis.
Yeah.
They grew the corn, had a sterile packaging technique, sent it to Paris or somewhere in France. They then extracted the drug from the corn, and that was much less expensive than synthetically producing the drug. And the thing was, you had to grow this corn in an environment where this genetically modified corn would not get away.
Yeah.
Well, believe me, if it got away up here, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah. Well, you know, and well, what they, you're talking about the right thing. You know, you have to grow a protein. And normally what they do is they grow it on the back of rats, and then they harvest it off the back of rats, which that's what, you know, so when environmentalists kind of say, well, you know, we can't have genetically modified product in here, it's like, well, we're harvesting on the back of rats. But anyway, you can do it off corn. And they're growing these proteins on corn stalks, and they're harvesting it, and they're using other things. But it's like I said, you know, there is controversy out there, because if you do it in Iowa or Illinois, and that stuff gets out, and, you know, let's be honest, it's you can't be 100% sure, you know, and all it takes is one tornado. I mean, you can say it's not going to happen, but one tornado, you know, is gone. You know, up here, yes, I don't think you'll have too much trouble. And the thing is that...
Any problem with gooey ducks?
Only if they grow protein.
I can't help myself.
But the big thing is they don't need a lot, because they designed this corn stock to produce a lot. And for the most part, everything probably could be grown. Well, a lot of product can be grown in greenhouses.
Right.
And if you want to bring that up, yeah, that, I mean, somebody wants to invest in that, that would be something.
This genetically modified corn was worth a small fortune.
Yeah.
It wasn't a lot of corn at all. And because you needed an environment that you grew it off season, you sterilized the area around the area you were growing, and you made sure if the pollen got away, nobody else was receiving it. Up here, I keep thinking of, even in Palmer, we have farms. Yeah. Put up a greenhouse.
Right.
Or not. Because it's hard to grow corn outside of a greenhouse. It doesn't do well. But, man, and I thought a person with an acre could have a farming operation.
They could.
Indeed, they were willing to and able to do that. We do seed potatoes. Mm-hmm. Because they're disease-free, we're able to send them to Asian countries who desperately want the disease-free seed potatoes. And because the winter is kind of brutal on the fungi, that on problems in other places. Unfortunately, that works pretty well in the Mat Valley. It does not work well in Kotzebue or in any of our rural areas that are in fairly difficult climates. Well, that is the place where I'm searching for some help.
And well, that's where you need to talk to your friends at Monsanto and genetically modified cold-resistant cabbage. Because, you know, if you got a demand for it, they can come up with a product. But I think you're bringing up another issue, which has been a real interesting discussion on the rural, which is there are some parts of rural that can't get decent food. And I think you just kind of identified it down in Bethel, where you can't get, you know, $9 for a cabbage. Now you bring that up to USDA, and when you go talk to Tom Dorff, if you bring that up to him, that's not on their radar screen at all. Because in their mind, if you're in a rural area, all you have is food. You know, you're dripping with food. It's there. It's cheap. No, not so. And there are places in the Southwest. There are places in the West. And there's places in this state that you just can't get decent food. And there are efforts out there. New Mexico's initiated an effort where they do farmers markets in rural areas where they're getting the food and then they're shipping it out there so people can get fresh produce. I mean, you can get, you know, Kraft macaroni and cheese that has a half-life of, you know, can you get the fresh cabbage? Can you get the fresh vegetables and the fresh fruits, which is what the USDA food pyramid says you need. It's what CDC says you need, but you can't get it out there. Well, New Mexico has this program where they're going to start sending up these farmers markets. They're going to get the product from actually in the valley down by Las Cruces and ship it out to Gallup and some of those areas where they don't have capability of getting fresh fruits.
I have a question just about that. So who is paying for it to be shipped from the valley to
those areas?
The state.
The state legislature appropriated the money.
Okay. And what do you do in a state where the majority of the legislators are in the rail belt, so to say, and they don't want to fund things for the other areas, then what choices do you have that's left over?
Well, I'm not, I mean, New Mexico's in the same boat. Everybody lives in Albuquerque and Las Cruces. So it wasn't really a big, you know, this wasn't a big problem for them. But it was a big problem when you go out and say, well, look, we're paying extra on our Medicaid dollars to these areas out here because, you know, these people don't have insurance, which means we pick it up. And if we're not able to get them a way to live a healthy life, we pay for it. And it's a lot cheaper to chip, you know, $500,000
there's
is nothing.
There's the problem.
Well,
we don't pay for it. There's no Alaskan that pays for any state government.
Well, there
unless
you
they're
go.
A corporation or something. And so
say that to Exxon.
You know, but none of the people in Alaska.
No income tax.
You know,
no
there's no sales
well,
tax. There's no income tax.
I knew
there's
no sales and no income, and I know you get your nice little bonus at the end of the year, but which has made me thinking about moving, at least for a month.
No, got to be a year.
It's got to be a year and a month then, and but that's how they sold it down there, is basically to say. Public health is affecting all of us, and it affects us all economically, mm-hmm. not just, you know, it's one thing to say, well, that poor person, they're not, those poor tribal people, they're not getting, and something else to say, well, that's going on our rolls, because when they get sick, it goes, they go to the emergency room, and you guys pick up that tab, and, you know, obviously, I'm not going to get into the economics of Alaska, I'm not going to debate you on that one, you're going to beat me every time, but... That's how they were able to bring it forward. But it's a big, you know, it's an issue that doesn't get discussed. And I think my point is, because I get hauled back to D.C. and, you know, sit down in groups and they kind of ask, well, you know, they start talking about rural development and they talk about all the stuff and that goes on. But they never really hit on the issues that really hit the West. And that's what I really like to start being able to really address.
What can we do?
Keep feeding me these antidotes. Keep helping Carl get to my meetings. Keep come to a few of these meetings. We're going to be having Kellogg Foundation is doing a meeting in the last week of June. And anybody who wants to come, let me know because I'll probably can get you a ticket to it. It's going to be in D.C. For some reason, all rural meetings are held in D.C. But it will be, they are going to be talking to the rural caucus, and they're really going to be starting to hammer on what do we do next to really build this whole rural agenda up. And nice thing about the Kellogg Foundation is, you know, they have a lot of money. You know, they're not Exxon, but they're better than North Dakota, trust me. And so we can probably use that to leverage some discussions, is the way I like to put it.
Is there an opportunity to make a presentation? I mean, I could go there and say, let me give you a synopsis of a rural condition for which we have not hit upon any kind of resolution on what we can do.
There probably would be an opportunity. They're having me try to get Randy Owens from Alabama, from the group Alabama. So you're up against him.
No problem. I can't.
But I think more important that we start getting that dialogue out there, because like I said, you know, when I go to a meeting and I see Canadians there, they're talking about Canadian issues, and the people that have to make the decision, they're hearing that. And, you know, a week, a month, a year later, they go back and they're sitting down, they're talking, and they said, you know, this Canadian started talking about this, and I can relate to that, okay, because I heard it. But we don't have in our country, with the exception of some states like Idaho, which really are very aggressive, and that may have been because of Governor Kempthorne. It may be just inherent with them, but they for a state of a million and a little over a million people, they have been very aggressive and very much out there. But they're unique. Most states, even the big ones, California, New York. They step back and just say, well, you know, we can't do anything about it. And so these international groups and these federal agencies, they hear from who are there.
Is there any place back east, and I mean the East Coast, that's considered rural?
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, what is rural? More than 5 miles?
Yeah.
Is rural?
Yeah, you remember, were you with us when we went up to Congress and met with, his name's Peterson, he's from Pennsylvania, the new chair of agriculture from Minnesota named Pennsylvania, he's named Peterson, but this was the Pennsylvania Peterson, and he was very proud of his district, which is the largest district, congressional district, east of the Mississippi, and it's, you know, I'm not gonna, it's not that big, but it's the biggest one, and he was the chair of the Rural Caucus, and, you know, he's a very good voice, and I do respect his voice. He made some good points, but that's what they consider rural. And one of the interesting things is our former president was John Herson from Maryland, and we worked with USDA and the Census Bureau to come up with this synopsis to define who's from a rural area, and you come up with size and income and, you know, how many people per square, and we crash this whole thing in, and Herson's name's coming up, and I said, well, he's from Chevy Chase, Maryland, which is a suburb of, but just, you know, data in, data out, and I think we, you know, there, we had some legislators in there that I really thought should have been in there, but they didn't, you know, get fed, it didn't trigger up with them. Rural is, this is not something that you can say, well, you're a rural legislator and you're not, because a lot of times there are rural legislators who say, look, I got this district, it's not that big, but I believe in this rural development stuff, and I have a city in there that's suffering because he considers it rural. Now, granted, it may only be 20 miles from a major city, but still, in their mind, that's what has to be done. In this state, yeah, you know, majority of the legislature is probably from Anchorage, I'm assuming, Anchorage and Fairbanks, and maybe none of them consider themselves rural, but you can turn around and probably identify certain people there that say, yeah, we do represent rural areas.
Are the feds pulling back on support for rural development, or actually are they advancing?
I'll give you the dirt. 2002 Farm Bill, part of it, one of the things they come up with was the Rural Strategic Investment Act, a whole title. And they were going to give money to rural development, have meetings, have White House meetings, have summits, do all this stuff. It's all in the act laid out. And the budget office cut it. They went from like $10 billion to zero. This time around, I don't know really what's going to happen. They had a great opportunity and nothing happened. This time around, I don't know how that's going to play out, if they're really going to act on this or not. There are a lot of disincentives in Congress for rural America. Mostly, congressmen are from rural areas are getting defeated. They're just moving on, I think is a big thing. You talk about some of the big advocates that have been out there. They have been stepping down. Bob Dole is down. Castlebaum is, I can't remember if she's still around or not. She's gone. Charlie Stenholm from West Texas, he lost his seat. It's just demographics. Demographics are against rural legislators, and that means everything in D.C.
So it's a shift for rural legislators to be replaced by legislators who are more urban character.
Right.
And that's nationwide?
And it's going to happen every time we redistrict, we have more seats that are from urban areas and urban suburban areas, and rural legislators have less clout. And it's just something that's a reality, which means that the rural folks really have to make themselves known and say, we got some issues here, we got some problems, we need to be recognized on.
But we don't have the clout. We have the problems, we don't have the clout.
We have
rural areas, we don't have the development.
We don't have the clout. I mean, legislators are suffering just like rural America.
And I'm glad you're here. We don't have the solution either.
No.
I mean, we can talk about a solution. I'll look at Bryce. He lives pretty rural. extremely rural, I guess, from the point of view of where we are today. And Peggy Wilson, who lives in a place, you know, you get on a boat or you get on a plane or you're not going anywhere, and the boats are not frequent enough and the planes are probably not frequent enough. And then we get to Paul here in Homer, which on the road system, Scott on the road system, Vic and I on the road system, not a problem. We don't consider ourselves rural. Mm-hmm. We think we're the rail belt. My goodness, we're the city. Anchorage certainly is the city, but mm-hmm. we have a third of our population, I think it's roughly a third, that is not on the road system as we know it, the rail belt from Fairbanks all the way down to Homer. I think that's two-thirds of the people. But that other third is scattered like shotgun pellets.
Yeah.
And that for us to help them establish an economy where they can have some self-sufficiency, we don't have an answer.
I don't think there's not an easy answer.
One,
I think there's
in the building today is some people that are dealing with the education issue of mm-hmm. broadband, and they were here yesterday and they spoke to economic development, broadband and how valuable it can be with regard to education. And I think you're probably onto something, and that is education is going to have to take some sort of a significant change from brick and mortar schoolhouses where we have brick and mortar.
Mm-hmm.
To maybe either more centralized, where we bring in students to come to a Mount Edgecombe type environment, or we operate in the places where we are, but without a building. Mm-hmm. We operate out of homes. We use the disks, we use the computers, and we use the satellites and anything else we can get our hands on, including fiber optics, to have a classroom.
Right.
Otherwise, we may price ourselves out of education. That's the fear, because we keep adding and adding and adding, and there's obviously a limit.
Yeah.
Our revenues are okay, but only because our prices are high, not because we're producing volumes anymore, and we're 10 years away from a gas line. And Representative Coring here, the chair of Oil and Gas, is meeting today at 5:30 to discuss the bill from the governor on how to, and that's our future, Doug. That is the entire future that we have, is that gas line. And there's possible.
You're telling me about the gas line. Is it, I'm sorry, where's it coming from? Where's the?
Well, it's coming from Prudhoe Bay.
And
it's got to get all the way to Alberta.
Okay.
And it's probably $20 billion. Maybe it's less,
30.
Maybe it's 30. More. Well, I think 30 was Chicago. We're not
right.
Talking Chicago anymore. We're saying we can send gas to Alberta. They need some themselves.
Yeah.
We have some takeoff points to help
urban
Alaska.
You're talking about a natural gas line, right?
Yeah, 48-inch, 50-inch, something like that. Very high pressure, 3,500 PSI.
You know, it was fascinating. A few years back, when I first met Tom Doerr, and he's the Undersecretary for Rural Development. He's the person I hope to introduce you to. He's a corn farmer from northeast Iowa. He's on the Federal Reserve in Chicago. And the reason I think the Bush administration picked him is because he doesn't believe in subsidies. He thinks it hurts the economy, doesn't help. But it was interesting. I was sitting with him once, and we were talking about energy, and energy prices were skyrocketing. And we started talking about windmills, and he goes, well, you know, where's the wind? Well, it's here in North Dakota. Where are the people? Here in Chicago. And in about 10 minutes, he had an economic development plan, you know, tapping into certain, certain funds, certain grants, certain things about we get transmission lines, we get, you know, we pay the farmers this much to drag the transmission lines across, pay them this much to allow the windmills there. And he had this whole business plan written up in about 10 minutes. And, you know, and I think that's what we got to start thinking about is how do we get these 10-minute business plans worked out where we're not just spinning. You know, you don't want to – this is probably not the time you'd be building the natural gas line. We should have done it 20 years ago. But we are where we are. And there are people in Chicago who will pay quite nicely.
Right. It is what it is.
Yeah.
And we're in the planning stage. We have to worry about – well, it's a whole story. We have to worry about the markets, the price of gas, how to float enough revenue to build it, who gets to build it, what direction does it go, what size pipe do we have, and most importantly, the producers own the gas, and what's the arrangement between them who ship the gas and the people who build the pipeline? Is it one and the same people? Where's the state's involvement?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to become a document dictionary-sized.
Not to mention the Canadians.
We have that issue. National Energy Board, First Nations, and Native sovereignty. You're right.
Are you going across Native land?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
But we think we have companies in Canada that can help us to do that if they become part of the organization and part of the economic agreement that we have. That's why we're 10 years away. We're not going to, that gas will not hit a burner tip for 10 years, hopefully from now.
Yeah.
But it might be from next year, 10 years, but hopefully from now. And I know Representative Coring and I are willing to kill ourselves over this, but that's what we'll do, you know, whatever it takes. And we got a new governor, we've got new commissioners, we have a whole new beginning. And I think it's favorable for us to look ahead and say, I think we can do this. But years ago, we tried and it didn't work.
Yeah.
So it isn't like we haven't tried. We never got a deal that wasn't giving away the farm.
Right.
And that's what we wanted to do was to, if we're not shipping gas and making money, then we're doing it as a charity, and we can't survive as a charity. But I want to thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I certainly appreciate it. Coming here from, occasionally we send people to other places, and it's really fun to have somebody come here that represents NCSL, and I know the message. I hope you know, you get to take it back and say, listen, I was with these guys up there, and it's worse than you think. It's hard for them to do what we consider the solution. And not that it's hard, so forget them, but we need the dreamers who can come up with the ideas for us.
And I'll leave my PowerPoint with Heath here, and so he'll have a copy if anybody wants additional. And you know, and again, either call me or send me a quick email if you have an issue, and let's see what we can do to figure this out. And even if it's just, hey, this is driving me crazy, I can at least help try to identify some places to forward it onto.
Some of the areas is $8.60 for a gallon of milk.
Oh.
You know, that would be very, that's going to be a fun issue for me to bring up,
too. Price of beer where it's $8.60 for milk.
I don't know. Ask Mary. She can tell you.
You got to keep milk refrigerated in the beer.
Were you the one who was telling me about the cows? They used to have the dairy up here in Juneau, and all the milk tastes salty because they all eat the seagrass? Now somebody.
It wasn't me.
It must be Carl.
They had cows here, and they may still have a cow or two, but but the dairy industry has evaporated from Southeast. The 747 was the big change, where you could fly milk from Seattle to South Central, and you were okay. Hard to compete with that milk price by having local dairies. We still have some in Mat-Su, but they are struggling is a generous term.
Well, at $8 a gallon, that's...
Well, it's not for us. I forget what it is. $4 for a gallon? I don't know. I haven't bought...
Me neither.
$2 a half gallon is probably pretty close, so $4 a gallon. If you want to stay, we're going to deal with a pretty amazing issue here, and that is the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Okay, that'll be
some
great.
Some issue on corrosion. And who gets to pay type of thing, and maintenance, and a lot of issues. We dealt with it yesterday, and I'm about to return to that conversation with the people who essentially own the pipe and the state, et cetera, et cetera. So you're welcome to stay and hang in on the committee meeting. We've only got about 45 minutes left.
That sounds great. Thank you very much.
I want to comment that the pipeline is mostly rural.
Who's going to benefit?
That's right. Quite worked out.
Pardon me? Okay, let's take a. Can we take about a 3-minute recess so I can check with Heath on the direction we're going?
Oh, good.
When we left off, I'm not sure. I'm trying to remember where we were, who was speaking, and because we have Representative Olson, it's his bill, but Heath, do you know help me to continue where we left off. Who was up and?
I wanted to say we were talking to Jonathan Iverson.
Oh, Iverson, yeah.
He should be online.
Mr. Iverson, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is John Iverson.
Well, I'm glad you hung in this long. I'm not sure if you were listening to the previous hour and a quarter, but I appreciate that you stayed online as long as you did. Are you able to continue from your previous testimony?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to answer any questions and testify to the extent you would like me to. We've also got Kevin Banks from the Department of Natural Resources and Rob Mintz here again. He's an attorney on contract with the Department of Revenue who's assisting me in this instance. So if you are interested in testimony from them, they're on the same line here with me.
They're with you online in the same place?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Kevin. Kevin, do you have some testimony for us?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I could just a few brief remarks if you want to hear from me.
I do. Thank you very much. Proceed. I'm always willing to hear from you, especially when we deal with oil and gas issues.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Banks, for the record, and I am the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And I wanted to please let the committee know that the Department of Natural Resources is in support of this bill. And I wanted to take a moment and talk about just a few items with respect to how I see the a process unfolding if this bill is passed, a little bit about what the Department of Natural Resources can offer in the process. And then, well, that's what I wanted to talk about. As I see it, this is the Section 19 in the bill suggests a change or a new category of costs that could be that would be eliminated from a potential deduction in calculating the PPT. If should there be repair or replacement of property that has somehow been improperly maintained.
Kevin, I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes.
Because we're dealing with this word pretty constantly, and improperly. Does DNR have a definition of improper?
It's my understanding. I can go into that a little bit, but it's my understanding that John Iverson has been working with Legislative Legal Services and also coordinating with me and folks at the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission to come up with a way of phrasing this so that it is fairly clear, or more clear perhaps, and also which references wording that we've seen in other jurisdictions and in other places. Without drilling into it, let me try to explain how I see this working or playing out. I think this is a provision of the PPT that would not be used very frequently. I suspect that what we could anticipate is that an auditor, say, after reviewing the costs of a taxpayer and recognizing that during the audit period that they are working on, that had there been some kind of failure, that might be an indication of a problem. That would be the first flag for this auditor to consider, that maybe something's gone, that has happened. At that point, the Commissioner of Revenue under this provision would be able to consult with the Department of Natural Resources, with the Conservation Commission, or DEC, and ask those agencies, and depending on the kinds of expertise that they can offer, whether or not something untoward had occurred, or if the failure that occurred had happened because of the as we talked about, improper maintenance. At that point, the commissioner of, say the revenue commissioner comes to the Department of Natural Resources. The Department of Natural Resources reviewing the evidence that they may have available to them, information that may be supplied by the Commissioner of Revenue about the taxpayers' costs and the nature of those costs, and also based on the kind of work that we will be in the future be doing under the Systems Integrity Office, we'll be able to assemble an opinion about whether or not a facility had somehow been, quote, improperly maintained. And the Commissioner of Revenue at that point can basically take it or leave it. He's asked for advice. He is only required to take it into consideration in making a decision about whether or not the cost is a deductible or not. And frankly, the Department of Revenue may actually turn to others, their own experts, perhaps, in making that determination. The Department of Natural Resources is now embarking on an effort as a consequence of the events last spring and summer to create the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office, and that office will be responsible for collecting information about how facilities owned and operated by our lessees are being maintained. And it will rely on the internal controls that the operators normally use in scheduling maintenance. It'll rely on various industry standards. You've heard people talk about API, the ASME, and other organizations that provide certification and other kinds of standards, and also the operators' own internal controls for maintaining equipment.
Kevin, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. Representative Wilson would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, from what I hear you saying, it's not all in place yet, but you're working to get all this in place, and it kind of sounds like that you can do what this bill says already from what's in the PPT bill. Would you address that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I would say this. We are going to be extending the oversight as the landlord over the operations conducted by our lessees. The purpose of this organization is not to provide as a routine basis information that is relevant to a taxing authority of the state. I mean, what we are doing is going to assure that the facilities in operation in the oil fields are being taken care of. And where the two intersect is in the case where a revenue commissioner comes to us and wants to know whether or not equipment has been maintained appropriately. And we will, when we're up fully up and running, have some evidence to share with the revenue commissioner at that point to answer that question. And, in fact, I would suggest that a lessee, knowing that the potential that costs directed towards maintenance activities might not be deductible under taxes, may have the incentive to provide our Systems Integrity Office with information in order to establish that they have properly maintained their equipment.
Kevin,
and the evidence that we may collect in that case would serve as a benefit to establish that, in fact, they had the lessee in this case or the taxpayer in this case had quite legitimate costs to be deducted.
Kevin?
Sir?
Does it require an on-site person, or are you going to decide on the poor maintenance or non-maintenance based on evidence of a leak, or based on evidence of corrosion, or a pipe shutdown, because I'm pretty sure we can have a shutdown in the line for any number of reasons, none of which are improper maintenance. So is there a test, essentially, that would be used to decide whether or not we had proper maintenance, improper maintenance, failure, or anything else, and is that simply going to be a on-site person from oil and gas or DEC or from the state, basically?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I see it kind of working out this way. As part of the normal routine function of a systems integrity office, we will be examining the records and the documents provided by the lessees that illustrate what kinds of maintenance plans, equipment replacement planning they have, and then we'll verify that what they said the lessees said they were going to do, in fact, that they did it. There will also be on-site inspections occasionally to make sure that equipment is in place that the lessees say they need to have, and that that equipment matches the kinds of standards and certification that we would expect in the various settings in which they are employed. The idea is to make sure nothing happens. If there is an event, a pipe springs a leak or something like that, well, that's evidence of a problem, and then we start heading down the road, I presume, and it won't be the systems integrity office that starts pursuing this, but it may be as a consequence of a tax audit that there is a potential issue that a failure has occurred because of some notion of improper maintenance. Under those circumstances, as I mentioned earlier, the Commissioner of Revenue may come to the Department of Natural Resources and say, can you help us determine whether or not this was an accident or whether or not it was caused by gross negligence, as may be indicated number six in this in the PPT article that we are referring to here, or is it something in between, and which is what 19 is trying to address? And it's at that point that we can turn to the kinds of records and information that we have to help establish that.
Representative Wilson has another question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, I'm going to go back kind of to where the question I had before, because I guess what I want to do is establish something in my mind before we go on to this bill. What you can do with the PPT tax bill that we already passed, and in that bill there were some thoughts laid down in the bill, some words laid down in the bill that would cover some type of situation that we have now. And so I guess can you now, and maybe you don't even have your regulations in place yet, so maybe you can't answer this, but could you now, because of regulations, disallow BP's request for a tax credit if you so chose to? And I guess I just want a yes or no there, so I kind of have an idea where we're at now, so I need to know where this bill is going that's different.
Well, Representative Wilson, and through the chair, I'm probably not the right person to give you the yes or no answer. The regulations regarding the implementation of terms like improper maintenance, gross negligence, and other aspects of this particular section of the PPT is going to be the responsibility of the Department of Revenue. And perhaps Mr. Iverson could answer the question for you.
Yes, this is John Iverson, through the chair. There are a number of provisions in the PPT already. The primary being in regards to excluding costs attributable to gross negligence that would be applicable to these sort of repair costs. We have a number of tools to exclude costs under the bill, under the current language. of PPT, but this bill would help to clarify whether we can exclude costs that are attributable to improper maintenance in the absence of gross negligence. We certainly may be able to get the costs at issue that have been mentioned several times before this committee and other committees excluded. However, this makes it bulletproof. If I were to write a reg that specifically references excluding costs attributable to improper maintenance, that reg would likely be challenged legally. If it's already in the statute, it stands a much better chance of legislative scrutiny. And I would ask Rob Mintz if he has anything else to add to that.
Rob?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson. I just expand slightly on that. I would say that there's an area as to which the current law is clear, and there's an area as to which it's not clear. The area as to which it's clear is the exclusion of costs due to gross negligence, as Mr. Iverson just explained. And that's an obvious and clear exclusion. But gross negligence is a much narrower category than I think what this bill is trying to get at it, with lack of maintenance or improper maintenance. The part that's less clear is the general definition of what are called lease expenditures or deductible costs, which are the ordinary and necessary and direct costs of exploring for developing or producing oil or gas deposits. And in interpreting that general definition, the current law directs the department to look at typical industry practices and standards in the state that are reflected in the types of costs that may be billed under joint operating agreements. That's a very fact-intensive question, and if the department looked into this and determined that improper maintenance type costs, such as the bill is addressing, are typically disallowed by industry practice, then it would be on firmer ground in disallowing them. But the facts may be otherwise, and in that case, the department would pretty much have to rely on the gross negligence standard. So, yeah, I totally agree with what Mr. Iverson said, that if the legislature is interested in making clear that costs due to lack of or improper maintenance should be excluded, then legislation is the way to do it.
Okay. Thank you. Rob, Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, it sounding like you're excluding the part under lease expenditures, and I'm referring to the enrolled version of 3001, page 28, where it talks about costs that can be deducted, that costs other than items listed in E, which are, of course, all these ones that are excluded, this section, that are incurred by the operator during the calendar year, that are billable to the producer by the operator in accordance with the terms of the agreement in which the lease of the property is subject. So under that provision, then there's another fallback, so that if the other producers within that lease do not allow that those deductions were legitimate deductions or were caused by negligence, or that they don't allow, then the state automatically doesn't allow them as well, or can exclude those costs as well. So it seems like we have gross negligence, we have negligence as seen by the other owners of that lease for the operator's negligence. If that's not allowed, we don't allow it either. So can you tell me then, in reference to that, where is this new standard of improper maintenance come from our standpoint, if the other owners of that lease don't consider that the improper maintenance was enough to not allow that to be deducted from the operator's costs that they're billing them? At what point does our standard of improper maintenance come in?
Chairman, Representative Seaton, yes, that's a very good question, and the representative is quite correct that if, in fact, costs were in a unit that was subject to a unit operating agreement that the department had approved or required using under subsection C or D of section 165, and then in that case, if the producers basically disallowed the bill, then it would be disallowed for tax purposes as well. And, of course, in that case, we'd be throwing in our lot with the way that the basically the way the dice would fall in terms of how the agreement would be implemented. But if I understand the more specific question Representative Seaton is asking is, okay, let's suppose that the bill before the committee is passed, but there's a situation where the costs are billed under an operating agreement and the other producers, the partners, do not dispute it, they pay it, then the question is, would we have to allow it as a deduction? And the answer is no, because subsection C and D specifically exclude all of the items listed in subsection E. And I'd refer the representative to the lead-in language to paragraph 1 on C1 on page 28 of the bill and D1 on page 29 of the bill. So it says basically that the lease expenditures that are deductible are the costs other than items listed in E of this section. And E is the list of the currently 18 or would be 19 under the bill items that are excluded.
Yes, follow-up?
And that's what I was recognizing. These are all of these, whether it's the gross negligence standard or the, as AGOCC said, the strict scrutiny or strict liability clause of 16 if there's a spill. And then we have this third fallback that we're just talking about in lease expenditures if they're disallowed by the other operators. And, you know, I guess if we're talking about standards of the industry, and we're talking about standards that are used, I mean, is your position that the other owners are going to automatically roll over for these big high costs, or you would expect them to roll in and pay a good percentage of these high costs if they attribute them to negligent operation of the unit? And if that's not the case, then we're talking about a whole series that is beyond what they would disallow for negligence. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Seaton, I'm not sure I'm competent to really predict how the other owners are going to behave. I mean, I haven't personally confronted this sort of situation before. I do recall that I think at one of the early hearings on this bill, perhaps it was the House Oil and Gas Committee, a representative from ConocoPhillips, which is, of course, a major partner of Prudhoe Bay, talked about their corporate policy with regard to bills. And I think he said, I don't want to misquote him, I'm sure it's in the minutes or the record, that their corporate policy is to challenge bills that they believe are due to gross negligence. And I think he also used the phrase something like the acts of an imprudent operator. I believe that the witness said that a determination hadn't yet been made about what their position is on the particular costs that have to do with the pipeline corrosion.
Mr. Bullock, since you're the drafter, would you mind sitting front and center? And maybe there'd be some questions that you could help with.
Mr. Chairman, my name's Don Bullock. I'm from Legislative Legal Services. I'm one of your attorneys.
Our attorney, right? This is great.
There might be a couple of things I can point out that might help you in deciding what to do with this bill. And first of all, I think is the appreciation as to what a deduction does and the decision that was made during the PPT to allow the producers to deduct the lease, so the allowable lease expenditures in determining their tax. And so the legislature decided, okay, you can take those deductions. The tax rate's 22.5%. So if there's a dollar deduction, the state's apparent sharing 22.5 cents of the cost. And in addition to the deduction that is allowed in determining what the amount of tax is to be paid, there's also a credit for certain qualified capital expenditures, which gives them another 20% of their qualified capital expenditure. And to be a qualified capital expenditure, it also has to be an allowable lease expenditure. So this bill presents to you how much risk does the state want to be for certain costs. Because it sets the standard. You talked about negligence quite a bit the other day, and in terms of what's improper maintenance and no maintenance is clear. But before you can talk about negligence, you have to start from somewhere. You're negligent because you didn't do what was expected. You come up to a four-way stop, you expect the other driver's going to stop. So it's the old standard, reasonable, prudent person that's kind of the standard. So so what this bill does is that, first of all, it requires the Commissioner of Revenue to look at what is good oil field practice. This is presented in this bill as the standard, is that we're going to give deductions for costs, but we expect a certain level of performance, and that's where the good oil field practice comes. So that's the starting point. And how much of a deviation from what you expect is good oil field practice will be determined by the Commissioner of Revenue as to what they did was improper maintenance. It didn't come up to the level of proper maintenance to prevent a major expense. If I could address one other question that came up the other day about depreciation, is that this has, the PPT has some aspects of an income tax. So you start with the gross value at the point of production and you're allowed your costs, but they're all expense. There's no capitalization. There would be for the income tax. So what you're looking at is regular maintenance costs would be deducted over the year as they go. But if they weren't done, equipment was being improperly maintained. And all of a sudden in 1 year, you're going to have a disproportionate deduction to make up for what wasn't happening. So if it's a cost that could have been prevented, then maybe the state, the question that this bill presents to you as you consider it is the state going to share in the cost of something less than what you may find to be an acceptable standard?
And I have a question too. If indeed in year 1, 2, and 3 we had normal maintenance costs of 1, 1, and 1, or a total of 3,
mm-hmm.
and in the fourth year, let's say we didn't do the maintenance, and then in the fourth year we have a maintenance of 4, which would have been normal, 1, 1, 1, and 1. Should we penalize the company for doing all their maintenance in year 4, which would make it proper, or should we penalize the company for saying you didn't do maintenance in 1, 2, and 3, so you're not going to get year 4?
Well, it's not only the history of the maintenance, but it would be always be held up to the standard. Should they have done something in year 3 that resulted in an extraordinary cost in year 4? Did they deviate from the standard of good oil field practice? And this bill has two aspects of it. First of all, it tells a producer what level of performance is expected, that they be consistent with good oil field practice. And secondly, if they don't, the state doesn't want to share in costs that could have been avoided.
Well, then I have a harder question. If in year 4 you only have an expense of 3 instead of 1, 1, 1, 1, and 1, should we reward the companies for delaying their maintenance until year 4, since they seem to be more economical to do that? Or should we penalize them for not doing 1, 1, and 1?
Well, that's another thing that's in your bailiwick. And you do that in the forms already in the bill of giving credit for development of new equipment. I mean, that is something that you can consider. The narrow scope of this bill is just to address the level of operation that's expected for the state to share the costs.
Yeah.
Representative Seaton.
We were talking about life expectancies before. If something has a life expectancy under the standard, I mean, I'm still unclear what the standard is. But under the standard of improper maintenance, if something has an expected life of 20 years, and we're in the 22nd year and it breaks and it shuts down the pipeline, is that, and we say, well, geez, the oil wasn't changed at the right interval, but it's beyond its useful life. Does that, where does the amount of maintenance and the useful life come into the aspect of improper maintenance and B and C for a shutdown or a partial shutdown or the liability for those?
That's I think that's one reason why the sponsor intentionally asked the Commissioner of Revenue to look at what would the expected standard be. Now, however, I mean, it's logical to assume that toward the end of a useful life of property, it's going to require more maintenance. It is getting older. It's just like when you rent an apartment, you know, you're going to absorb reasonable wear and tear, but not unusual wear and tear. I think the other day you mentioned that something had a 23 or 25-year life, and that after 23 years it required major expenditures. You know, it's not just out of hand that those expenses wouldn't be allowed to be deducted. It's just whatever would be the standard. What does good oil field practice require after 23 years? What kind of costs would be associated? So one option that you would have is to put presumption to this bill that could be clear examples of something that should be done, and if it's not done, wouldn't be good oil field practice. It was mentioned in the Special Committee on Oil and Gas how often they had run an inspection pig through there. I mean, mm-hmm. You, as a policy matter, you could say that certain inspections have to be done in addition to whatever good oil field practice is. You have that option.
I'm curious because as it stands, I love this. I really love this. It says, cost of that portion of the cost determined by the commissioner in consultation with the commissioner of environmental conservation, comma, the commissioner of natural resources, comma, and the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and taking into consideration the standard practices of the industry, and then it goes on. And I'd say, you will never arrive at, this would be almost an impossible standard to meet. I wish we could just say, you know, we're going to hire Charlie Smith. And when Charlie says it's improperly maintained, then it's improperly maintained. Is there any way to get to an easy standard? Because this is such a high standard in consultation with a whole bunch of commissioners.
Well, I think part of the question you're facing, is this a high standard or is this just the standard that we expect? We expect good oil field practice. When you go to the gas station to get your car worked on, is 4 out of 5 tightened lug nuts all right? I mean, the wheel's not going to fall off. If there's negligence in repairing your car, are you going to pay to have it fixed? I mean, what, you know, the state is sharing in the cost through these deductions and credits. And so it's really a question, and it's a policy question, of how much latitude you want to allow. What are your expectations? And as far as the difficulty of making the decision, it's not uncommon. This is a tax thing. If you look in 4355-165A, which is the first subsection in this section that's being amended by this bill, it talks about ordinary and necessary costs. That's the rule of thumb. If you're looking at your travel and entertainment deductions on your individual income tax returns, it's a judgment call. In the PPT, it said ordinary and necessary in subsection A, and then it says in subsection E, these are costs, even though somebody may consider them to be ordinary and necessary. The legislature says we're not going to include things like gross negligent costs as ordinary and necessary. So this subsection E, in which this amendment is proposed, is the area where you decide how much risk you're going to take, what costs are you going to share, and through the lease expenditures and qualified capital expenditures, which expenses are you going to allow credit to be taken.
I keep, and no, Representative Signal, just a second. I keep coming back to the 30 cents. The 30 cents was put there for a specific maintenance reason. Would it have helped if we never had the 30 cents and we just said, listen, deduct the maintenance cost, or should it be 60 cents and make a higher bar yet, or something different? I mean, I wish this bill was easier, but we're trying to get there.
I think, you know, when you look at the 30 cents, that there may be different reasons to have the 30 cents. It may be just to say that we expect the producer to share the, you know, to bear that, the burden of those costs up until 30 cents times the volume of production. One of the ironies of that provision, though, is if you have malfunctions, you have a decline in production, so the volume goes down. The 30 cents times the lower volume, what broadens the deduction that can be taken, because it lowers the threshold.
I'm going to give Representative Seaton the last question here, and then I'm going to hold this bill over. Go ahead.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, my concern is that as I look at all the other ones set out, they're pretty firm, you know, whether it's gross negligence or whether it's, you know, costs for containment and cleanup, or whether it's cost to satisfy a work commitment on exploration. All of those things are pretty. But I get to this one, and it just seems like it's that the industry is going to have a very hard time pinning down what proactively is going to be determined in retrospect if something happens to be having been improper maintenance. And it seems to me that part of the whole idea here was to grant some knowledge and some security, and it seems like that this standard is going to depend more upon whether we're running a deficit or a surplus in the budget than it is a definite standard of what's there. And so I think that maybe the idea that you said of putting some presumptions in there, you know, might help. But I'm one thing further that I would like to get clarified is under 19 where it says costs or that portion of costs, and one of the commissioners that would be deciding this didn't seem to know whether that meant what that standard is. I mean, we don't have any standard for. At one time, will you decide all the costs, and another time you decide part of the costs, and is it based on the lifetime of the, or how much of the life expectancy of the part is gone, or is it just in the severity of the shutdown? Maybe you can draw me some parameters on that.
Okay, but we wanted to adjourn.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to end just say that this Friday at 1 o'clock, we're going to meet here again. And I'm going to be accepting testimony on what constitutes good oil field practices. And it may be when we know what improper is and we know what good is that we actually get the best possible understanding. And it may be we should be working off what good practices are and say everything not good is improper. I don't know, but I know Conoco will be here to give us that information. With that, I'm going to adjourn. Thank you very much for attending.